From the Sky News Centre at 5. A man arrested after a shooting inside a church in the US state of South Carolina has been charged with 9 counts of murder. Charleston police say 21-year-old Dylan Roth is due in court later. He's also charged with possession of a firearm. The victims include a state senator who was also the church's minister, described by locals as well-loved.
A wonderful human being. He was a very blessed heart. He would give your shirt off your back if you ask for it, he will give it to you.
It's just a tragedy altogether. It just hurts right now.
Airline officials are trying to work out if 2 people stowed away on a BA flight from Johannesburg to Heathrow. It's after a body was found on top of a building in southwest London. Rachel Jewell reports.
The incident happened on the busy Kew Road near Richmond. Hadi Koshkabari works at a printing shop close by.
This is not the first time. This is the 3rd incident in this area.
A second man is critically ill in hospital. Reverend Neil Summers is leading prayers in Richmond.
It just shows how desperate people are to come to this country and to seek a better life for themselves.
Meanwhile, a bunch of yellow flowers has been left at the scene by Ealing carpenter Charles Campbell. He says he was moved to bring them because he thought no one else would.
David Cameron insists more can be done to stop radicalisation at its source. In a speech at a security conference, the Prime Minister says communities should take responsibility and that many individuals aren't doing enough. Russia has stepped into the Greek debt crisis with what appears to be an offer of financial aid just hours after the breakdown of talks with the European Union. The EU has called an emergency summit for Monday. Prince Harry's career with the armed forces has ended today after 10 years. A statement from Kensington Palace says he considers it a huge honour to have served his country. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
Hi,
it's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news is newly elected Green councillor for Cabot Ward here in Bristol, Annie Stafford Townsend. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, you only write what we want you to write. With free food and drink, the predictable G7 meeting in Bavaria was a journalist's heaven. But it quickly turned to hell last week for journalists trying to cover NATO's biggest banksters and corporations' secret after-party for the G7, that is the Bilderberg Conference over the border in Austria. Anything can happen. And it's nice if you can actually do your job. Meanwhile, Daily Mail claimed this week that only 5% of one British city's beggars are actually homeless. It's like blaming Muslims, but it's just another lie. The Daily Mail's job seems to be to blame the victims. Bristol has 15,000 officially homeless, and with benefit sanctions, the bedroom tax and evictions last year at the highest since records began, the queue for homes is growing. But Bristol's hundreds of homeless youngsters are not going to sleep in shop doorways. And since Ken Clark made squatting residential homes illegal when he was Justice Secretary, scores of 18 to 24-year-olds have been banding together and sleeping in hidden office squats, like the former probation office to Courcy House near Brunswick Square, for example, brought back to life by scores of Bristol's invisible, discarded youth. Faced with a government that seems to care more about rising house prices than housing anyone that can't pay for it, we're joined by Green councillor from Lancaster, Chris Coates, after the 6 o'clock news, who's actually been building the houses and communities of the future. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 14 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 21. A generally cloudy weekend with few showers, though, on Saturday. Next week, highs of 21. Showers on Monday, but the rest of the week, plenty of sunshine. Next weekend, that's the 27th and 28th of June, highs of 21. Sunny spells and some showers. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. com. So helping us review this week's news is a Green councillor for Cabot Ward, Annie Stafford Townsend. Hi Annie, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
Now first of all, tell us why you got into politics and why the Green Party.
Oh, why the Green Party?
That's the easiest one first.
I first started being interested in politics in the early 2000s. That was kind of the first time I was eligible to vote. And I couldn't vote Labour because of the Iraq War, as well as a few other issues. And so I started voting Lib Dem because they were left of Labour at that point. And then obviously Lib Dems went into a coalition with a Conservative government, which is definitely not what I voted for in 2010. And therefore, I did...
You were left with the Greens, were you?
Not that I was left with the Greens, but I... You know, have you come across sort of political compass type quizzes and vote for policies and all those sorts of websites?
I've done one or two, yeah.
And it sort of charts the where a political party is on the spectrum. And as I looked on it, actually, the closest to my politics, which is very left of the centre, is the Green Party. And they are the most progressive on social justice issues currently.
But they've got no MPs, have they? So what you're doing is you're... Yes. but not a lot of power at Westminster. And that's where most of the big decisions are made.
It is, but we have a lot of power now in Bristol. We have 14 councillors after the last election. We made great gains. We're the third largest on the council now. So we've got a significant quantity of sway locally, and that's needed now because we're going to really need to put up a good fight against
well
the,
that's very good for your morale, and it's very good for the Green Party's morale. But it doesn't really change a lot because George Ferguson makes all the real decisions, doesn't he? Again, a bit like Westminster, far away, we've elected all these people, but can you actually as councillors really change things?
It is true that he has executive power, and therefore our powers are more limited than they used to be as councillors, which is something that we don't agree with. I mean, we campaigned against an elected mayor system as the Green Party, and it's not the most democratic way of doing it, but it's a system we've got. So we do have the power to scrutinise, and we do, and to hold them to account, which we do.
Tell us a bit about your background. What do you bring to the politics of the city personally?
I am from Bristol. I grew up in Filton. My dad used to work for Rolls-Royce. He used to make Concorde. And then he left Rolls-Royce, actually, when it started to build only military aircraft. And so he left on principle, which, you know, tough times, early 80s. But, so he's a plumber, or was a plumber. He's unfortunately retired to disabilities now. So I've got that background, kind of activism, but not thought of or kind of called activism, but it is activism.
What do you make of the closure of the airfield? Because I was interviewing a chap called Maurice Kirk earlier this week, which is going to be on a programme next Tuesday, lunchtime dialect we do, which is a sort of sister show. Maurice was taught to fly at Filton, and he was the first person in a RAF chipmunk to fly underneath the Severn Bridge in 1966 when it had just been built. Obviously, it was a big centre for aviation. Actually, Filton, at the end of World War II, was building more aircraft than anywhere else on the planet. Actually, nowhere else was building more than Filton, because there were a lot of satellite places where aircraft were being part assembled and being put together there. Of course, with all the Rolls-Royce stuff and the engines being made, it's really being run down, isn't it? I mean, the airfield now closed.
It has. And obviously, as a Green Party person, we're not overly keen on travel such as airplanes, because we'd like to see more sustainable, more environmentally friendly forms of aircraft. So it's not a bad thing if the aircraft industry kind of winds down a little bit. Obviously, it's not going to. It is a major employer, obviously, out there at Filton. I'd like to personally see more affordable homes when we're building homes. One of the major issues with that is the lack of transport infrastructure.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's what's happening. Basically, the airfield is being covered with housing, isn't it, now? Yeah. In a way, it's a natural change. You know, BAE Systems, private company that owned the airfield, have said, well, hang on a minute, there's a massive demand for houses in the Bristol conurbation, so we're just going to sell the place to housing developers.
And I think there's a huge problem with... It's better that we build on brownfield sites when we, obviously, greenbelt, but... More than that, we have hundreds and hundreds, thousands of empty buildings in this city, empty office blocks. We just keep on building more empty office blocks that, you know, they've never been occupied, let alone the ones that then the people move out of one office block, leaving empty into a new, swankier one. And then we have more empty office buildings. We have enough already built buildings in this city to house our homelessness situation several times over, and yet those buildings remain in the hands of hedge funds, investment bankers, those sorts of things that keep the hold of them as an asset.
So what would you like to have seen done up at Filton with all that space then? I mean, assuming it's going to be used for housing, what kind of housing?
I would always like to see sustainable housing in terms of energy efficiency, affordable housing, and an infrastructure in place that actually supports that housing. So it has to include enough schools, it has to include better public transport so that people don't have to be reliant on cars and they don't have to go and jump in their car just to go get a pint of milk. That's not a situation that we want anywhere in this city.
The only other thing is, of course, it was a massive employer. I mean, I was looking at a film, I can't think it was a British transport film from the 1950s of the shifts turning out at Filton with literally thousands of people coming out of work at 5 o'clock in the evening, getting on buses. And the film was actually about how the Bristol Corporation buses actually managed, when so many people needed to get all on the bus at once, and they did manage it. You know, they had like a load of extra buses just to ferry people from Filton back into the city centre and to their homes. But in that now, the industry's completely run down. Almost completely gone.
Agreed. And we need to...
It's not just aviation. There's all sorts of other things that go with it, like GKN, that kind of thing. Maybe I could just bring you on this, Martin, because where do you stand on all this? Is this just inevitable, the way that places like Filton that used to employ so many people have now just run down and being turned over for housing?
Well, the British manufacturing has been undermined by, you know, for generations, really, by the dominance of finance capital over the way Britain allocates resources. So things like property bubbles, I mean, even now, with the economy supposedly growing, the balance of trade on material trade is massively negative. And we just don't make and build things anymore. And of course, there's a tendency for people to say, well, we should just get back into that. The problem is that once you've got out of building stuff, you never get back into it. You have to actually then, you really do have to diversify there, because you really can't just, we can't become Germany now. We've blown the opportunity. And of course, you need an industrial policy, which we've just been lacking
for
years.
Well, how did this happen? Because Germany was blown to bits 60, 70 years ago. How come they've recovered, but we haven't?
Well, because what we did was we imposed on Germany, as part of the post-war settlement, a series of checks and balances. So you've got strong regional governments in Germany, which have a lot of powers. The trade unions were given a very strong role, and you've still got workers on the boards of companies in Germany automatically. And of course, none of these things, it was all done in the British occupation sector as a means of making sure that the Germans would behave themselves going into the future. But it actually worked very well for Germany. But of course, none of it was done in Britain. We didn't do any of it.
There's a lot of talk in this country at the moment about wealth creators. But by wealth creators, it's actually ignoring the people that create the wealth, which are the workers. The workers actually do the work and create the wealth, but they're not paid a living wage, they're not appreciated for their work, and then we're only valuing things that have a monetary reward. So, like, for example, women who raise their children, that's not valued in our society and culture at the moment, same as people who care for the elderly, care for children, care for those that are vulnerable. Those things aren't appreciated, and it's only people who, you know, the more money you earn, the more valuable you're seen. That's what is being talked about as a wealth creator, not the people that actually create value.
It's worse than that, because what they call wealth creators are in fact many of them parasites. The people who've been involved in the LIBOR scandals, for example, rigging the world's interest rates in order to line their own pockets and those of their shareholders, are not wealth creators by any shape or in any shape or form. They are basically redundant and damaging You don't want those people doing those things, and the idea that they somehow create wealth which the rest of us take off them is absurd.
Can I just say something about, because we've got this fascinating libel trial? Well, it's fascinating to us because we've been following the case of Rain Man for about 3 years here on the show. Tom Hayes was a libel trader who was headhunted from bank to bank because he knew how to fix it, and this week, in fact yesterday, he handed over a UBS instruction manual on how to rig libel, the prosecution has said.
Well, yes, and of course, the very, very limited fines that these people, the institutions have been fined, not even the individuals. So that's no deterrent at all. You know, if the organisation you work for gets fined, what deterrent is that to the people who work for that organisation? And in any case, the amount of money they made on all of this was far in excess of any fine that they've been given. And of course, they've basically been stealing from local government all over the world, who bought these swaps and options based on interest rates, which were supposedly not manipulated. So that's a straightforward sucking of wealth from cities like Detroit into Wall Street and the City of London. That is not wealth creation at all. It's the exact opposite, in fact.
This is a trial going on at Southwark Crown Court. What do you make of this, Annie? You know, this guy is on trial, but he's saying, look, I've got a manual from my employers that I was following about how to fix the LIBOR rate.
I think it's far too easy to pin things onto scapegoats quite often. I don't know the details of the trial. I'm not following it, I have to be honest. But, I think we have to be very cautious about individuals being scapegoated for something that is clearly the culture of a company that's benefiting from
that. Yeah, they haven't been cautious in Iceland, Martin, have they?
No, I mean, obviously they've taken a rather... of course, the Greek government this weekend is considering its options, and the left wing of Syriza are saying, well, look at Iceland, you know, they didn't pay their debts, they defaulted, and they put various Icelandic bankers in jail. And the deposits of the citizens of Iceland were protected, but no foreign nationals had their assets protected.
What they've done, essentially, is they've said, well, look, this and this deal were fraudulent, so they're not valid and we're not paying them. Now, you know, if you translate that into the Eurozone, you've got quite a massive bunch of people saying, well, we're not paying that, haven't you?
What may happen if Greece does leave the Eurozone, and it looks like looking increasingly likely, is that they will simply repudiate a large amount of this debt. And in actual fact, that's the textbook allows for that. In theory, people pay interest on debt because they run the risk of losing the money. And, you know, and when countries or companies go bankrupt, they go bankrupt and the debts are cancelled. And there's no problem with that, in theory. But, of course, in actual practice, what will happen if Greece leaves the Eurozone, in my view, it's already probably taking place, is that the Deutsche Bank will collapse, the biggest bank in Germany, which will push Germany right into the...
Oh, I don't think the Germans will allow that.
Well, that's why they want the Greeks to stay in and carry on paying, to preserve Deutsche Bank's
asset base.
Don't
they now own most of our post office as well, and various other things? let's talk about some more local stuff, but this isn't local, but Caroline Lucas has made what I thought was a wonderful... She's the one Green MP who I neglected earlier in the programme. I too, she says, welcome the Honourable Lady to her post. Will she tell us whether the Chancellor intends to make a habit of announcing policy to a room full of bankers based on a secret review by an investment bank with no public consultation? Did he even consider the alternatives, such as turning RBS into a network of local stakeholder banks like they have in so many other countries, as a perfect example of localism in practice? What she's doing there, Martin, is talking about what we were saying last week, the NM Rothschild & Sons private investment bank report to the Treasury, saying that now is a good time to sell RBS shares, even though the public is going to be losing something like 1.5 or possibly more billion pounds on the deal.
Well, yes, it's correct. They didn't mention anything about this in the election campaign, of course, and then to say you have an independent advisor, NM Rothschild, saying, well, I think you should sell the bank to us at a knockdown price.
Are you saying they're not independent?
well, they are bankers and they intend to buy the shares, so it's not, you know, I don't suppose they're going to say we're not going to buy any of the shares, are they?
Bristol Mayor George Ferguson is disappointed at the Cabinet members' U-turn on Avonmouth Docks lease sale this week. Bristol Mayor George Ferguson, this is in the Bristol Post, said he was disappointed after an assistant mayor, one of the several, Mark Bradshaw, made a U-turn on his support for the sale of the leasehold a paper of mouth docs at the cabinet meeting last night. That's on 6th, that's a couple of days, or Tuesday, I think. Mr. Bradshaw, one of two Labour candidates shortlisted to stand against Mr. Ferguson in next year's general election, said the plans needed further work. So, Mark Bradshaw is out of the cabinet. I'm not sure quite if Labour have only got one person in the cabinet now, where they did have two. What are your thoughts about this story this week and on the Avonmouth docks sale?
Well, we opposed the docks sale and believe it's too big an asset and too valuable a plot of land to lose from our local authority ownership. In terms of Labour leaving the cabinet, if you remember back to the early days of the Merrill cabinet and his Rainbow cabinet, Labour actually refused to join the cabinet at all. It was only later that they joined it. We knew that they were going to choose a moment to leave because we have an election coming up in 10 months' time. It's part of the preliminary throwing down of the gauntlet. Mark Bradshaw is going to potentially be a mayoral candidate. It's between him and the candidate they had last time round, it seems. It's all part of the big game of politics locally, which I don't think should be played with
Martin,
local people's
lives. What Annie's saying here is essentially that it's very difficult for Mark Bradshaw to be campaigning against George as mayor if he's sitting in the cabinet with him. And he's had to find an excuse to leave, really.
He's starting to
make a bit of a fuss.
Well, it may be that I don't know what his motivations are, but it sounds perfectly plausible that that's what's going on. I was one of those that was probably opposed to joining George's cabinet, but I recognised that I was in a minority. Quite a lot of people felt that it would have looked churlish in some respects not to go in, and I accepted the views of the majority on that one. I think I'm still opposed to having elected mayors. But we've got, as you were saying earlier, Annie, we've got to work the system we've got until we can get it changed.
Yeah, agreed, which is why we've continued to have an assistant mayor as well in Daniela Dvijici. But we will continue to review that as the situation changes and as austerity comes in further and bites more. We will review it periodically and there will very likely come a time when we can't actually support the cuts anymore and we will take a stand against them.
I noticed that the mysterious Lib Dem cabinet member Simon Cook has stepped in to take over the portfolio that Mark Bradshaw had. Simon Cook, I've been asked many times to come on this show. He just replies occasionally on a text saying, keep trying, Tony. But it would be nice to have Simon, as he's an actor, but he just seems a little bit shy to come on the radio, a bit strange. But anyway, Simon, if you're out there listening, please do come and tell us what's going on, because it's nice to hear what's going on in the cabinet particularly. Also, more pieces on this week. I can't remember a week where I've seen more pro-George Ferguson pieces in the Bristol Post. Almost every day, a couple of pieces. I mean, even the way that said, the cabinet members made a U-turn. Well, I don't imagine that Mark Bradshaw thinks he's made a U-turn. He might explain, well, actually, the reason I've done it is on principle that something's changed, or I've been told something I didn't know before. So, the way it's spun is crucial. another one, I think, is it on the same day? No, it's actually, that was a couple of weeks ago, the 3rd of June. George Ferguson steps in to help Clifton Trader, blaming residents' parking zone for taking business to the brink of closure. That's a while ago, though, that one. George Ferguson appeals for financial backers as he launches a bid to remain Bristol Mayor. That is this week. George Ferguson launched his fight to stay on as Mayor of Bristol and is calling on members of the public to help pay for his election campaign. Well, I think he's more calling on business people, isn't he, to do that. What are your thoughts on George and how he's done as mayor and where he stands? Because he's actually, the way I can figure it out, he seems to be quite close to the business community, that he's now saying to them, give me some money so I can be re-elected.
I'm pretty sure he could probably self-fund if he wanted to be honest, because I think he's short of pennies. He does try to portray himself as a green mayor, and a lot of people wrongly think that he's actually a green mayor.
Well, he's brought Bristol Green Capital to the city, hasn't he?
Not really. That was a lot of different people's work, as much as he'd like to claim credit for that. He's not as green and as social justicely minded as an actual Green Party mayor. And quite frankly, if you want a Green mayor, you should vote for a Green Party mayor.
Have you announced who your candidate's going to be yet?
We are currently coming to that conclusion. So it will be September, I believe, that we'll announce ours. I think a lot of what George has done would come under the greenwash label, to be honest.
I mean, what about, say, for example, I mean, he's bringing in this amazing new public transport, the Metro bus, for example.
Well, it's not that amazing. I mean, it's dug up a lot of allotment.
Well, I mean, Bristol's been waiting for probably 20 years, maybe even longer, for some kind of public transport thing, hasn't it? You know, whether it's a tram or a Metro bus or whatever.
We definitely need a better transport system. I don't think Metro bus is it. Unfortunately, that's actually a deal that was locked into by the Lib Dems rather than Mayor Ferguson. It kind of backdates from before him, I believe. There's a lot of issues with Metrobus, and I don't think it's going to actually solve many of the issues that our transport system has. I think what we really need is to bring the buses back into council, local authority ownership.
Is that realistic, though? Because buses cost quite a lot of money, don't they? Have the council got enough spare cash to buy them back?
Well, their contract expires at some point, so therefore soon. There is plenty of scope there. We don't have to give it to them again.
That's right. And I think even Mark Weston, who's a Tory leader, has said he's willing to consider public ownership of buses because it's just such a no-brainer,
really.
They're
appalling, aren't they?
I mean, you see, the problem is what's happened in Britain is the privatisation of buses, which I remember when it happened, was a disastrous decision. It was a silly thing to do, and we've paid the price ever since. And we get used to having a third-rate policy imposed on us, and then we just put up with it for decades. And, of course, in places like Stockholm or Seattle, they look at this and think, what is the matter with you people? Mm-hmm. Why are you so dogmatic about this? Mm-hmm. I mean, getting your public transport infrastructure right is absolutely essential if you want, you know, to have an industrial policy and all the things we were discussing earlier.
It's crucial in order to actually be environmentally sustainable for people to actually be able to get to their employment in a way that they can actually afford and on time. And those things don't happen. There's no guarantee a bus is ever going to turn up if you go and stand at a bus stop at the moment.
No. Well, you know, it's path dependency, isn't it? You end up... You know, we can't. I mean, Bristol's got aspirations to green, sustainable policy, but in practice, the traffic in Bristol is probably some of the worst in the country.
Yeah.
Even despite everybody's aspirations.
Exactly. I think it is supposedly the most aggressive and furiously congested roads outside of London.
I think this idea of things coming back into public ownership, we've got to break this where we do actually do it. Mm-hmm. It's because we've had years and years and years of public assets being sold to the private sector, mismanaged. We've got to re-establish the principle, as the Greens called for in the election, for example, to renationalise the railways, which has got
definitely
an overwhelming support in the population. And as you say, it doesn't actually cost a load of money because you just wait till the franchise comes true and then just draw it back
It's
in.
Not going to happen, is it? Not on a Conservative government. No, just, you know,
but in the end it will happen around the world. This is the I won't call it nationalisation, but the idea that the public sector has a significant and worthwhile role to play is going to sink in the end, and it's got to. There's no way.
But the public sector's broke, Martin. It's not going to happen.
It's not, though.
No. The banks are broke, and they've broken the private debts of the banks have made the state insolvent all over the world. And ultimately, of course, I'm a Marxist. I think there's going to be a major crash. And when we have that major crash, there's going to be all sorts of consequences which people at the moment are incapable of grasping. But once we get there, and it could be caused, for example, by Greece leaving the Euro this weekend, we will be in a different... We won't be in Kansas anymore.
I think it's next weekend, possibly, isn't it? Anyway, one of the big stresses on all this, of course, is population growth and migrants who are being forced to leave their... The BBC calls them migrants. I don't. I call them refugees because they're coming from places where they used to have reasonable jobs. We're talking about Central Africa and Libya, places like that. But where now you've got gangs running around with machine guns who are just taking over and there's no proper government anymore. So they're getting on these, they're not really migrants, are they? I mean, they're talked of as economic migrants, but this was brought up by Hilary Benn, who was standing in for for Harriet Harman, because David Cameron was away in Italy, and so George Osborne, if you can follow all this, George Osborne was Prime Minister on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions. So let's have a listen to this question about the Mediterranean refugees from Hilary Benn asking George Osborne about it.
Hilary Benn.
Turning now to how we resolve the crisis, which has seen, as the Right Honourable Gentleman will know, the largest movement of refugees since the end of the Second World War, can he tell the House what expectations he has for the new round of talks that UN Special Envoy Staffan de Mistura is holding in Geneva?
Well, first of all, of course, he's right to talk about the displaced persons, particularly in countries like Jordan and in Turkey, who are bearing an enormous burden. That is why Britain has such a massive aid contribution. And I think, again, across this House, we can be incredibly proud that the parties in the recent general election stood on a commitment to deliver 0.7% of our national income in development aid. And it is in not just a humanitarian effort, but also to make sure that we're able to help in situations like this. When it comes to burden sharing across the region, of course we want to help, but I think we have to be realistic. We cannot take large numbers of Syrian refugees into our country.
Well, I find that quite extraordinary, because all the evidence suggests that the British intelligence services have been intimately involved with their NATO allies and their Gulf Cooperation Council allies in the arming and training of jihadis being infiltrated into Syria. The former French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas is on the record in France as saying he, when he was Foreign Minister of France, he was approached before the Arab Spring by British officials who said, "We are going to run an armed uprising in Libya. Do you want to put in Syria?" That was Libya, wasn't it? Are you going to participate? Now, in other words, MI6's fingerprints are all over the destabilisation of Syria and Libya, and now we've got all of these refugees. And Britain say, well, we don't want them. Well, perhaps you shouldn't have destroyed the countries they're coming from in the first place. And ultimately, this is going to be very difficult, because the violent...
I'm going to ask Annie this in a minute, Martin, but what's your thoughts about whether we should take some of these? If we're responsible for it, surely we should be taking some of these refugees.
Well, even Nigel Farage in the election campaign was saying, well, because we've bombed Libya to pieces, perhaps we've got some responsibility to take some Christians, he said. because obviously the Christians are now getting massacred in Libya and Syria, and perhaps it's our responsibility to do something about it. I think this is going to be extremely difficult. Do you know where the people, the place in Europe where they have the most problems with this? It's Italy and Greece, who are actually the most vulnerable to leaving the Eurozone. And the British want to sit at the back of the class, criticising the Greeks and the Italians and all the rest of it. Meanwhile, we carry on provoking war with Russia in the Ukraine, trying to overthrow the government of Syria, and basically having turned Libya into a basket case. Other people are not really going to give David Cameron much of a time of day as he goes around begging for special pleading for Britain under those circumstances in the rest of Europe.
I would say that as a former global power and still one of the richest countries in the world, the UK has a direct responsibility to the refugees of the chaos that it's caused throughout the world. We are directly responsible, as already stated, for that current situation and other war zones around the world and the refugees that have been caused by it, and therefore we have a responsibility. It's not even debatable. We should be accepting refugees and helping as we should.
What do you think about the BBC's term for these people, which is migrants? I mean, it's sort of making out that these people actually are just trying to come to Europe to make a better life for themselves because they get paid more.
Yeah, I mean, it's an improvement on immigrants, but yes, they are refugees, they're not migrants. It's not the same as somebody coming and working for a while to make a better life, which I also fully support. It is a different set of circumstances entirely, and they need assistance. And that's also one of the problems when talking about immigrants, as often is, they actually mean refugees in terms of the support that we give them financially and in terms of housing. We're talking about refugees, and we're not talking about people that have just come over because they want to make a better life for themselves. And also, they should be able, all people should be able to make a better life for themselves.
So do you think that people should just be able to go anywhere they want in the world almost without a passport?
Yes. In a word, yes. That's my personal opinion.
I don't think realistically any state in the world can allow absolute free movement over
it's an borders. Interesting idea though, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's a bit John Lennon maybe, but you know, if you had that sort of situation, then surely you'd find people migrating towards the most successful countries.
Well, the free market textbook, if you're going to liberalise global trade, you've got to have free movement of labour as part of that, and you know, consistent free marketeers argue exactly that.
Well, that's what's happened in Europe, isn't it? In
well,
the EU.
But anyway, that's only within the EU. But in any
well,
case,
EU
the,
is most
the,
of
real,
Europe.
The real problem, I used to work in Poland in the 1990s, and the Thatcherite policies pursued by the Balcerowicz plan basically put more than half of Poland on the dole. Mm. And what they needed to do was to rebuild their own economy in a rational way, taking into account where they were starting from and where they wanted to go to, without just jumping into the deep end of free market everything. Because, of course, that then meant that most people didn't have any work. And then what do? They get on their bikes and go and look for it, where the work seems to be. But a lot of these people in the Mediterranean now, there's been far more coming in the last 12 months, 18 months, and a lot more have drowned because they stopped bringing the boats, you know, intercepting the boats and so on. This is clearly a direct result of the destabilisation of the Middle East by the Western powers since the invasion of Iraq in 2003. That's the direct responsibility. Yeah.
And the thing is, as well, is that if you talk to most refugees, if you go, I've got a lot of Somalis in Cabot, and if you go and you talk to them, they'd actually rather be back in Somalia, living a nice, calm, peaceful, non-war-torn life where they have their family and they're safe. That's what they would prefer. They don't want to be here in some mould growing flat in Redcliffe, and that's what I think often gets lost, is that we all or our media will quite happily make it out as if we have a much better all-round life here, when in actual fact most refugees don't want to be refugees. They want to go back to their lives in safety.
I mean, Yemen's just the latest, but so many of these countries around the Middle East, I mean, if you look at Iran, all the countries around Iran have been destabilised over the last 10 years or so. It's chaos over there now.
And it's a deliberately created policy as well. It's not as if it's an accident. I mean, in Somalia in particular, the Islamic Courts Union had managed to take over Mogadishu a few years ago, and they were actually stabilising the situation. They were preventing the various militias from fighting each other and establishing a basic... And a lot of Somalis here were thinking of going back.
Yeah, you know
They were talking about going back. And then the Ethiopians, put up to it by the British and the Americans, invaded Somalia, overthrew the Islamic Courts Union, which then split, and Al-Shabaab was a split off the Islamic Courts Union to fight foreign intervention in Somalia.
Isn't it interesting?
And of course, in other words, our policy destabilised Somalia yet again, and then of course they end up here.
But I mean, you know, my point here, Martin, is to be about the courts. You know, this is one of the things that seems to be absolutely crucial in Egypt, for example, as well. President Morsi, who was democratically elected, whether you agree with him or not, as he moved on the court system and on the system for appointing judges in Egypt, that was when he was then deposed by the Sisi administration. Well, basically a military coup to get rid of him. Just as he's trying to actually bring some democratic process into the court system, that's when he was moved out. And that's when then, literally a week after that coup, the Americans then handed over loads and loads of back payments of money to the military.
Indeed. In other words, we are basically supporting the military government in Egypt. And if people flee from that and come to us and say, will you help us? Well, we are directly responsible because we're supporting that government. And Britain in particular, as you say, has got a history of doing this all over the world. And it's not as if we've kind of backpedaled on it in recent years. Mm. We've been very much to the fore in playing these games.
But actually, having more migrants come to Britain is not a problem. I can tell you that because UK wage growth is accelerating now. The jobless rate is down to 5.5%, was announced this week. And Martin, what do you make of these figures? They're all actually extremely good, aren't they?
Well, no, they're not. What we've actually got
we've got less jobless than the lowest since 2007-2008.
Yes, but it's still well over a million people. And I think nearly a million people under the age of 25. The fact is the quality of the jobs is pitiful. The productivity per hour and per worker has collapsed in this country. It's quite clear that the economy is only just a little bit bigger than it was in 2008, and yet millions more people are employed. That means that they must be producing less per person. And in actual fact, we all know anecdotally what that is about. You've got, you know, engineering graduates basically selling barista coffee.
And Annie, this is looking good. Wage growth is around about 3%, the highest since December 2008 at the moment.
It's a fiddling of the figures. There's a lot of people who have been on Job Seekers who have been encouraged to set up a self-employed.
Yeah.
And that's great.
Working
great.
Tax credit.
Yeah, you get, exactly. You're not actually earning any money. You're supported by working tax credits, which are then being scaled back, as are all the other benefits, housing benefits. If you're then under 21 or 25, you're probably going to lose your housing benefit. People are actually earning less money, but they're out of the jobless figures because they've been shifted on to another term, or they've been sanctioned, or whatever other fiddle has been done. That actually means people are worse off. They're not showing up on the figures.
Well, I've even heard that people are now, rather than signing on, picking up things on the street and selling them on eBay, and that is considered okay for working tax credits. You're now self-employed.
Mm-hmm.
You're no longer jobless.
Yep.
That's right, and of course the international drugs industry continues to thrive, and a lot of people work in that, although we deny it.
Well, anyway, yeah.
The thing is that the Conservatives make a great thing of all these people setting up their own businesses, culture of entrepreneurs. Actually, most people who are starting out in business, they need support like working tax credits in order to actually get those businesses off the ground, and without them they won't be able to. If the Conservatives were really on about more than just the wealthy being entrepreneurs, then they would actually be making it financially feasible for people to work and still live and set up their own businesses, which they're not, because they're not actually about that. It's just about fiddling the figures.
Well, if you think one of the best ways of finding out whether you think the economy's doing well is ask a cab driver. Mm. One of the Bristol cab drivers, I was chatting to one earlier this week, and he said he's never known the situation so bad. Cabs are sitting there for hours and hours and hours without actually picking anybody up. The pretty shocking figure is that now around about two-thirds of cab drivers are simply not bothering to renew their licence because it's not worth their while to carry on driving in cabs. There are cabs you'll see from Cardiff coming to Bristol. There's cabs coming up from Taunton and from Wiltshire getting plying for trade here because there's no trade where they're coming from. They see Bristol as the only place that's got any cab trade at all. That sends a pretty strong signal to me, Martin. The economy is not picking up at all.
In fact,
it's going, you know, sort of horizontally.
Well,
down.
Well, no, right? What you've got to take into account, is we've had zero interest rates for 5 years. That's unheard of. And any upward tick in interest
but
rates.
But that's good. It means it's a bit cheaper to borrow money, easier to borrow money.
No, but if you've got a situation where you've got an anemic kind of economic recovery with everybody being employed in the way we've just described on low wages, low productivity jobs, which of course, again, we were talking about path dependency earlier. If you specialise in low wage, low productivity jobs, that's what your economy eventually becomes if you allow that to happen.
Yeah.
You know, the zero interest rates, and the other point is the Greens, of course, did raise the issue of citizens' income in the election. Mm-hmm. I'm a strong supporter of that. Ultimately, we've got to actually recognise that we need to support people. The capitalist economy is, in fact, quite an efficient setup, and that means we can, in fact, support everybody on a basic level, and that liberalises the labour market. people can, at the moment, people get into a poverty trap because if they go on to work, they're often worse off than they are in benefits.
Exactly.
And if you give people a citizen's income, then every hour you work adds to your income.
So, Annie,
and also gives people the security of knowing that they're not going to be allowed to fall down the drain.
Annie, why didn't the Green Party then go with the citizen's income? Because I know, I think it was Caroline Lucas, Natalie Bennett, the leader, had to backpedal on that, said, actually, no, I don't think we're going to do that because we can't afford it.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's one that I didn't actually overly agree with, I'll be honest with you. I'm a big champion of the citizen's income for all the reasons that's just been stated. And the way out of the benefit trap isn't to lower benefit amounts, it's to assistance income. It's a living wage, because at the moment minimum wage is not a living wage. And it used to be £7.50, it's now closer to £8 an hour is actually what you need to survive. And we also champion rental caps as well, because especially in Bristol the rental market is going through the roof. The changing of the stamp duty level and the way in which it works has meant that the property market is now skyrocketing to a point that is first-time buyers can just not afford to buy anywhere. Only properties that are being sold to investors and buy-to-let landlords, which means the rental prices are going up, and it's harder and harder to afford to live. And in terms of the economy itself, I run a retail business, and I can tell you that the money that comes through the doors of my own business and other businesses, it's not improving, it's not better. Local businesses, independent businesses, bigger businesses, they're all struggling. Their sales figures and their turnover figures aren't actually supporting this idea of increased inflation that we're being told that have.
That's interesting, isn't it? More evidence the figures are being fixed, folks. You heard it here first.
Yeah, exactly. Also, and it means that people can't be paid a proper wage, because if companies are saying that they're not earning enough money in terms of turnover, then they'll argue that they can't afford to pay a living
wage. Another spin-off of this is what we were hearing, right? I mean, we'll be talking about it in the second hour, which is places, old office buildings, which are now being lived in by scores of teenagers, people in their young early 20s, because they can't claim benefits, or they've been cut off for benefits for one reason or another, and they can't get work. Mm-hmm. So this is storing up a problem for the future. These kids are our future.
Mm, exactly. Well, affordable housing, affordable homes, they're homes, not houses, is what we need. And also turning empty office buildings back into homes is something that I'm going to be particularly championing for my time in the council.
On to another story now, and on Sunday, the Sunday Times headline was all about Edward Snowden and what a naughty boy he was, because the Chinese and the Russians had decrypted secret files which had put British agents at risk. But let's have a listen to Tom Harper, who wrote that story for the Sunday Times, on the front page of the Sunday Times, being questioned on CNN about it.
Well, I mean, the files came from America and the UK, so they may already have known for some time what Snowden took. Again, that's not something that we're clear on, so we don't go into that level of detail in the story. We just publish what we believe to be the position of the British government at the moment.
Well, that's interesting, publishing what the position of the British government is, but what about other positions, like, for example, whether it's an agent or an officer, intelligence officer, that's being talked about? Earlier this week, I spoke to the former ambassador, Craig Murray, who penned a rather entertaining piece, actually, five reasons why the Sunday Times MI6 story about Edward Snowden is a lie. And this is what he had to say.
I'm Craig Murray. I was in the British diplomatic service for 20 years, serving all around the world, and I worked very closely at various times in my career with MI6 and with GCHQ, so I've got quite a lot of experience of intelligence matters. The Sunday Times published a story aimed at discrediting Edward Snowden and claiming that the Russian and Chinese security services had managed to decipher the documents which Snowden had taken out of America and been leaking some of into the media, and that their having done so would put the lives of
British agents at risk and destroy Britain's intelligence operations.
They're not going to put something on their front page, surely, unless they've stood the story up.
Well, you would hope so, but there were some things in it which were very, very strange. The first thing that struck me was that it confuses the terms officers and agents. That's probably because, you know, because of James Bond, etc. It's confused in the public mind. People think that MI6 officers are called secret agents. In fact, in a world of intelligence and inside the British government, they're never, ever called that. People who work for MI6 are MI6 officers. Agents are informants, basically. You know, if you're an MI6 officer, you'll work out of the embassy in whichever country you're in, let's say Moscow for now, and then you will have local Russians who you will basically bribe and pay to give you information. Those people are the agents. The Sunday Times story confused agents and officers, and it wasn't just the journalists doing that. They claimed that they were quoting directly, you know, a government source, and the government source and the quotes in italics got agents and officers wrong. Now, anybody genuinely worked in intelligence would never make that mistake. So it was obvious that these quotes were not from a genuine government source with access to intelligence.
Surely the Sunday Times is not just simply going to cut and paste whatever MI6 wants them to put onto the front page of the paper.
Well, you would hope not, but the journalist who wrote it was later interviewed by CNN. He gave an interview in which he said directly that, you know, we just published what is the position of the British government. They didn't do any checking at all. It's not easy to reach Edward Snowden, but it is very easy to reach people close to him, you know, people who work with WikiLeaks, the people who helped get him to Moscow. I know these people. I can phone these people in the next half hour. The Sunday Times has an awful lot more resources than I do. They could easily have got the other side of the story, which is supposed to be something you're fundamentally meant to do as a journalist, but they didn't do any of that. It was really quite remarkable. I would just say that it wasn't only that thing on agents and officers which were wrong. There were many other things which were simply nonsense in the story, like the idea that the Russians were going to kill MI6 officers, that this was a danger. The Russians haven't killed an MI6 officer since the early 1960s. And there's absolutely no chance the Russians are going to start murdering MI6 officers now and start World War III. That's a ludicrous accusation to make. The whole story just wasn't credible. Being MI6 officers, etc., isn't really as dangerous. It's not like James Bond movies. They actually just work like ordinary diplomats. 99% of the time, more than 99% of the time, they have diplomatic immunity. They pretend they're a first or second secretary in the embassy. They go in, they sit in an office all day long. They're not taking the risk. It's the people feeding them information who are taking the risk. But the other thing is that, you know, the Russians work exactly the same way. Every other country works exactly the same way. You know, when you work in an embassy, and I worked in embassies for 20 years, of course you know that a proportion of your staff are spies, and proportion of the staff of all the other embassies are spies. And you put a lot of effort into working out who are the spies. And we always knew who were the Russian spies in their embassy, and the Russians always knew who were our spies in our embassy. And when they have tit-for-tat expulsions, the Russians normally don't expel the spies because they know who they are, and because they know who they are, they can keep an eye on them. They don't want a lot of new spies coming who they don't know who they are. We always expel the Russian spies. The Russians always expel the ordinary diplomats and leave the spies alone. That's rather peculiar and almost amusing. It's quite elegant in a way. But well, it's also an example of the way the thing is a game. You know, there's huge amounts of public money expended on the security services, an awful lot of which really isn't to very good effect, particularly in what the Sunday Times is talking about, which is a classic UK versus Russia spy game. when I was at the embassy, I always know, I knew, I was always told who were the MI6 officers. And they sit in a different part of the embassy behind different electronic screening and things. And you all mix socially and play football together and drink together and that kind of thing. So you know them extremely well. But the people whose names are never, ever written down under any circumstances are the agents. That's the local people who are giving you the information. Those names are never, ever written down. And if you have if you're producing an intelligence report, let's use Moscow as an example. Your intelligence report will say, this information comes from a source who is in frequent contact personally with Vladimir Putin, but not in an official position. Or it will say, this information comes from a source who sits on official committees and has good access. Or it will say, this comes from a source who is on the local council of St. Petersburg. It'll give that kind of information to enable the person reading the report to judge how important it is or how accurate it is, but it won't be enough to let you identify the person. And you never, ever write down the names of the people for reasons which are very obvious. Every single embassy has a room known as the box, which is a room which has no electric wires going into it at all. And there are no plugs, no sockets, no plumbing, no anything. And it's totally insulated. And it's insulated not just by concrete walls. It's insulated with all kinds of, you know, specially developed materials. So there's no way of penetrating it. And you get in there with very old-fashioned ways of producing light. And that's where you talk if you want to talk about something very, very secret.
What's your thought about what the purpose, assuming that this is made up, this story about Edward Snowden? What's the purpose of it, Craig?
Well, the purpose of it becomes very plain, because the initial source, which the Home Office, which the Sunday Times quotes, it says it's a Home Office source. Now, the Home Office actually has nothing to do whatsoever with MI6. But what the Home Office is doing is putting through the snooper's charter to justify massive data collection on the internet traffic and the telecommunications traffic of all of us. You know, everybody listening to this, the government is going to be collecting all your internet traffic and everywhere you've been on the internet. And I would say that, you know, GCHQ has admitted that they already have 800,000 British citizens' sex chats online. And these are entirely innocent people. You know, this is random collection. They weren't targeting people. They were just pulling up as many sex chats as they possibly could.
So sounds like this story was made up just to sort of build a case, Martin, for this snooper's charter.
Well, it does, doesn't it? It's just blatant manipulation. So the Murdoch Times produces what's basically already been debunked as a rubbish story. Glenn Greenwald was talking about this story, and he said, well, look, they say that Snowden's files fell into the hands of the Russians and the Chinese, but in actual fact, Snowden handed over all of his files to the journalists he was working with in Hong Kong, so he didn't have the files. They are basically manipulating public opinion shamelessly.
What's your thoughts, Annie, Green councillor for Cabot Ward? What's your thoughts about this snooper's charter, and where, you know, how justified is it? Because we do live in a dangerous world, we're told.
It is a dangerous world that our government arguably makes a lot more dangerous, and I don't think a snooper's charter is going to make it any safer. In fact, it would be the start of a very slippery slope that we don't want to be going down.
I mean, are we already down that slope? Because some would argue the snooper's charter is just making things lawful that the security services GCHQ are doing already.
Arguably so, but that doesn't mean that we should allow it to be made legal.
That was Annie Stafford Townsend. Lost my bit of paper there. Annie Stafford Townsend, yeah. Green councillor for the Cabot Ward. After the Murdoch News, you only write what they want you to write, with free food and drink. The predictable G7 meeting in Bavaria was a journalist's heaven. We're hoping to speak to the journalist that was over there for The Guardian, Charlie Skelton, after the news. The Murdoch News, that is, at 6.
Is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.